Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the system works, so let's get underway. Welcome to Concurrent Session 2G, where the topic is risk culture from the perspective of boards and trustees. If that's not what you think you're here for, you can respectfully relocate now. Otherwise, I'll introduce our very special presenter. Sean McGing is an actuary, a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors as well, and a former member of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. Sean's experience spans 35 years in consulting and corporate roles across a range of financial services. Sean has the joy of founding two actuarial firms, most recently his current business, McGing Advisory and Actuarial, which is based in Melbourne. He has also spent time as a partner at Ernst & Young. In the non-corporate sphere, Sean has 8 years' experience on a not-for-profit board and founded and chairs its risk management committee. Sean passionately believes that actuaries can add a lot of value outside traditional fields as well as inside them, partly by thinking differently to their co-workers. Please welcome Sean McGing, who will open by telling us how he thinks you're going to think differently by the end of the session.
Thanks very much, Martin. How do I hope you'll think differently? Well, I suppose the first thing is that you'll have an open mind. And I think the main thing that I've learned over the years is the importance of embracing the team that you're in, embracing the values of, you know, your own values and the company values that you work for, and really living courageously to those values. So that's really what I'd like to see. The other side is that I always like to sort of challenge people, I think particularly those, say, that are coming out of uni and have this wonderful career path ahead of them to do something in the not-for-profit sphere, to do something for a charity, and bring your actuarial skills, because in my experience, the value of having to think differently in many ways in those areas has really, really helped my experience, and I'll bore you with some of that as we go through today as well. Okay. As I noted in the synopsis, it's really important that we do think differently, and I love the theme of this conference, but it's also about influencing others to think differently, and to think differently about actuaries and about actuaries in the way that the other companies, other entities can use them. But we have to press that along. So today I'd like to share my own experiences on my personal different journey in many ways, starting traditionally and working through that. So bear with me as I give you some context in a few minutes around that. All of my career has contributed to my appreciation of the importance of organisational culture and stemming from that risk culture in organisations. So that's really the theme. It's more of a personal journey. I'll share my experiences, some of the things I've noticed along the way, and then when we get to the discussion, you know, we can open it wide up. I'm open to any sort of question. Okay, my career. There are upsides and downsides from 35 to 40 years of experience. And there you go, that's the difference. So moving on quickly. We were recently clearing out underneath our house where we've been for the 30 years since we came to Australia. And we came across a set of my posters that I used to have up on my study wall many, many years ago. And these are two of them which were really inspirational to me. And I really think that today they're just as relevant. You see some of those phrases used from time to time. But this is the opportunity. This is the opportunity to be different, to think differently, but more importantly, to act differently. And you really have the road to enterprise risk management in a nutshell there in those few lines. Each of us thinking differently about ourselves as actuaries is an essential first step. But it's not just thinking, of course. It is the acting. And you can't do the same thing over and over again without going insane. So, to avoid insanity, this is what I did with my career. Down the right-hand side, I've got a couple of characteristics around major decisions that I took along the way. And it is a bit busy, but I'd also like to share with you some of the outcomes from that and what I learned. So, starting at the very beginning, 1976, New Ireland, you know, I learned, follow what you love and opportunities will come. With Shield Life, that was a startup, and I really learned that even within a financial institution, people see the world differently. It's not just the narrow mathematical actuarial mind that you have when you go leave school or leave university. But all of that adds to your understanding, and relationships are for life. The move to Australia, follow your dreams, out of the safe harbour, you will be rewarded if you take the road less travelled. Australian Eagle, here in Melbourne, I saw that doing things differently can work really well, but that it takes time and effort and application. McMullen, Covington and Capsco, that was a fintech before they called them those things. And that was actuarially driven, and it was consultancy. I listened, I learned, and I travelled. Trowbridge Consulting, applying actuarial thoughts, structured thinking, issue analysis, but practical applications. And I had exposure to the electricity and gas markets. And there was no hesitation at Trowbridge about having actuaries move into those markets. Eagle Star in Ireland, I went back for 6 months on a contract role. I experienced the Celtic Tiger. I compared the Irish financial regime to the Australian regime. Then back to Ascot Consulting. I started Ascot Consulting, and that was probably the highlight of my career, looking back now. It was a startup, in today's terminology, and as founder and entrepreneur, I had the wonderful opportunity of actually creating the organisational culture of that place. I worked with a wonderful bunch of people, and it was a true team. We did things together, we discussed things. Even though I was the majority shareholder, it was an absolutely equality-based decision-making organisation. And it was great. And we got things done. So then 2008, joined Ernst & Young, and there I saw the importance of values, doing the right thing, quality, the power of relationships that you develop right across the spectrum. I also saw the quality and real value in an actuarial set of skills, whether we were talking to Telstra or financial institutions. The McGing Advisory and Actuarial, as Martin referred to, my current venture, which has been going now for 7 years, time flies. I've had a lot of interaction with sporting bodies, property developers, as well as a whole range of financial institutions. And again, the thing that has struck me is the importance of relationships, of listening, of partnering with people rather than pushing your own views. And realizing what you don't know as well as what you do know. And finally here, Siena College, this is the not-for-profit that I'm involved with. That will be a fair bit of the story as we go through. And there I've seen again the benefits of good governance, of good risk management, of living by the values of an organisation and how can that drives all the good outcomes that come from the organisation. Leadership right there, right up front, really important. Okay, so think differently. To achieve these outcomes, we need to act differently. And I truly believe that by acting differently, that's the only way that we are going to attain our full potential. We have it in each of us to bring those actuarial skills, develop the complementary skills, and really make a difference, whether it's in financial services or elsewhere, but we have that capability and capacity. So do act on it and make the most of it. Acting differently starts with you. You can start to change the world on your own, but you need to influence others to finish it. You should take risks, considered and calculated where possible, but remember the risks should always be appropriate risks within your agreed risk appetite. Now, that's terminology that's more recent, but really at its core, it's a great way of setting yourself up to take controlled, appropriate risks. And that's for you as an individual and also obviously for your organisation, whatever sort of organisation it is. Have backup plans, just in case something goes wrong. People often say to me that I took a big risk in coming to Australia. Now, I never looked at it like that. I could always go back. That was my contingency. For me, there wasn't a risk because compared to my six uncles that left Ireland and left the poverty there in the 30s and 40s to go to the States, those people took a risk. So it's all relative and it's all around how you can put things in place so that your risk is sensible and appropriate and that you're grasping the opportunity, the other side of risk. Probably the most important thing in all of this is to remember is that not taking action is the biggest risk of all. You've got to look out for the opportunities and take them when they arise. You really often get just one shot at an opportunity. So keep your eyes open, keep your mind open, be aware of your surroundings. Okay, so for the next 20 minutes or so, I'll just go through my own direct experience in these three case studies. Case studies is probably making a lot more of them than they are because we don't have a lot of time. I'll share these with you. So the first is as a board director and chair of the Risk Management Committee at Siena College, which is a not-for-profit. And the second one there is as an investment advisor to a national, again, not-for-profit, but it's a long service leave fund. And finally, because a lot of my work is involved in superannuation, just some insights from advising trustees. And I'm going to try and bring out the risk culture elements of all of this, and again, encourage questions at the end. So, risk culture within an organization. It's a vague term at times, and those of you who are very involved in enterprise risk management will have a lot of familiarity with it, but it's very difficult for others perhaps outside that to really grasp it. So let's define it first, and then we look at thinking and acting differently within that risk culture context. A good way to understand what risk culture is to actually read some of the papers that are out there. There's some good ones. The APRA had an information paper which just came out last October, and there was an institute session on it actually in Sydney, a webinar, a very good one. The material there is now quite good. APRA has matured in its understanding of risk culture over the years tremendously. So they've done the hard work. Let's make the most of that. Another item is the Financial Services Board risk culture paper, which is going back a few years, which deals with the aftermath of the GFC and how that all comes into play. So there's some excellent reading in there as well. And the Institute has a fair bit of literature. Some of it's been written by myself and Andrew Brown. And what I've done is at the back of the presentation, if you look it up afterwards, you'll find the references to all those papers just for your convenience. Okay, so definitions. APRA says that risk culture can be thought of as the impact of organisational change on risk management. Now, a full definition, which is summarised in this slide there, is a system of shared values that define what is important and norms that define appropriate attitudes and behaviors for organizational members, which is how to feel and behave. Now, behavior is critical. If you want to change culture, you need to change the behavior of the people in your organization. Risk culture really is the application of this concept to the way an organization manages risk. Now, there are many definitions of risk culture, and my favorite one is the one that I invented with Andrew Brown. After many reviews of a lot of very complicated ones, and this is just straight as it says up there on the slide, an organization's... Oh, sorry, did I? Ah, there we go. That's much easier, isn't it? Thank you. An organization's risk culture describes the degree to which its culture encourages or limits the taking of risks and opportunities that arise from those risks. So it's risks and its opportunities. And remembering that at its core, it is all about people and the behavior of those people. That's what drives risk culture. And more importantly, the outcomes that come from having a good risk culture. And on the other side, if you don't have a good risk culture, you're much more open to things not going well. Okay, so Siena College, as I said, I'm on the board of the college and I chair the risk management committee. 6 or 7 years ago, I was part of the task force which I chaired, which actually came up with the original risk management policy for the board and a plan and a framework. And if any of you are interested, I did a paper on it at the time with the encouragement of the college and presented it to the Financial Services Forum, I think it was, in 2012. As you can see, there's quite a lot of potential for risk across that lot up there. And the other, I suppose, parallel thing that I've observed over that period, mostly not at the actual school, but that's that religion and faith-based organizations are fascinating studies in themselves around organizational culture. In very many ways, they're the extreme. And you get the very good, but you also get the bad, as we know so well from some of the publicity in the last few years. The college's strategic plan has, in its mission statement, Siena College, a Catholic secondary school in the Dominican tradition, offers young women an education which challenges them to make intelligent and responsible use of their gifts and over time develop a lifelong love of learning. So that's what we're trying to do. And I also thank the college for encouraging me and allowing me to use their school as a case study in all of this. And to me, that in itself demonstrates an openness that is at the heart of a sound risk culture. Often when we consider thinking differently, we think of the buzzwords digital disruption. Now, in my view, yeah, it's like fintech and digital and disruption. They're ever-present elements in any organization and any industry. The pace has quickened enormously, and digitization has facilitated that complexity of change and speed of change, but also it offers fantastic tools to actually do something with it. But I thought it might be interesting to just share some thoughts on digital disruption at a school. So firstly, think of 750 teenage girls with phones, iPads, laptops, right? So there's plenty scope for risk and opportunity in all of that. A lot of energy and a great ability to disrupt in multiple ways. Now, of course, they're also teaching and support staff in the school. And here's a few of the risks and opportunities. Social media, real distraction to learning. The biggest change in risk at the school over the last few years we've identified as the increased danger to the girls' mental health. And that is really, really accelerated by social media. It's, I don't know if any of you have daughters or nieces or sisters. peer pressure is enormous, despite the wonderful standard of living we have. So that's a big change. So you really have to face these things head on and actually put things in place, such as extra counselors, integrated awareness across all the teaching teams, as well as the social support, the welfare, to maintain the welfare of these students. On the wasted resources, how much money do you invest in different elements to make things faster? Do you put iPads in the classroom? Do you, bring your own device? How wide do you spread that? These are challenges that can waste a lot of money, and schools tend not to have a lot of money. So there's risk and there's opportunity to take. You hope things won't be a fad, and you try and go through the process to make the decision right. On the opportunity side, fantastic opportunities for improved learning, better academic results from that learning. In terms of teaching, data analytics, we use analysis of student scores, both internal and external scoring, by teacher and student. Now, what's not to love about data analytics? And people are really looking at those things and seeing how can they improve the performance of the teaching mechanisms or the performance of the teachers themselves by going through that process. And different children learn in different ways. We all learn in different ways. Okay, I think happier students, it's easier to engage students with certain technologies and certain programs. The richness of the resources that are out there, both formally and on YouTube and the like, is fantastic. So really, there are great opportunities. In terms of risk culture, attitude and action, it's easier to be innovative, to be different, to embrace with the opportunities and the tools that the digitization of things brings. But not everything will work. Okay, so some insights. What has worked well from a risk culture perspective at the school? The clear things for me are good governance, the chair leadership, absolutely critical, and that's been very powerful. The team, the partnering across the team, both at the board level and across management, I've seen that work really well, where there's respect, there's sharing, there's diversity of views across the table. Continuous improvement and review. There's a challenge there. The board undergoes a review, both internal and external, and the committees recently have gone through a review. A deep trust between the board and the principal, who's our CEO, in effect, is amazing. If you don't have that, you really cannot make much traction. And in terms of openness and attitude and leading from the top, the principal's role is critical, but that principal has to have the full support and the trust from the chair of the board and all the board. The other thing is that there's a real recognition from the journey that we've been on at the school that risk management actually adds value. So they've seen that over the years. And that is a continuing journey too, and that's recognised, that you're always improving, you're always trying to maintain the pace and the quality of what you're doing from a risk management perspective. Risk is a consideration in every decision that is made, and opportunity and risk go hand in hand, so we try and look at both sides of those things, upside and downside, as we go along. And we do consider whether it's appropriate to take a risk or not, as the case may be, and if it is, that we're comfortable with that. A good example of this in practice is the school has a relationship with a community which is run by the Dominicans in an impoverished area of South Africa at Copenhagen, and it's in a very deprived area, so it's in the townships. And a few years ago, the school started an immersion program, so we sent about 10 of our students, I think they were year 10 students, year 10 or year 11, across with teachers, And so the upside of that is the enormous human experience of seeing others in the real environment. It builds a sense of social justice, but it just matures the mind enormously for those people, appropriately prepared. The downside is they're more vulnerable from a health and safety perspective, because there are more intangibles. So by using the tools that the risk management program developed in terms of looking at these external excursions and making them very, you know, very, very direct and honest and open and having discussions with people, that helped make the decision, yes, the opportunity is greater than the risk, so we did that for a few years. But this year we judged that the risk had changed, there was a change in the environment, and it was decided that no, that was just tipping the balance too much, and we would not do that program this year. But we will return and look at it next year. And that's a college operational decision, and they're just going by the board policy, and they are implementing the framework that's there and just using the tools that they have developed to drive that framework. Risk appetite is absolutely critical. I find it hard to explain it properly, but it's a difficult journey to go through the concept of risk appetite for an organization and for a school where you have people who are not familiar, one, with finance and secondly with a risk management way of looking at things. That's difficult. But we have gone through those conversations with the board. We've developed a risk appetite statement, looking at each of the areas of risk and setting limits around those. And that's been very, very helpful, I think, to the school. More than anything else, it increases awareness. Okay, so looking at some other elements, internal responsibility, that's the first line of defense for the school. So the school has its own internal risk managing committee. It takes responsibility for overseeing the risks. Specific leaders in the school are responsible and accountable for particular areas of risk. So there's the business manager has the financial risks, etc. So that increases risk awareness throughout the school. Safety walks are held periodically to check the labs and things like that. The college certainly targets a mature risk environment, so it's gone through the thinking around what does a mature risk environment look like from the culture perspective. And we have a matrix of risk maturity, which is considered every year and reported on. And that looks at ranges from immature through early starter, progressive up to mature in each of four areas, one being the use of standard tools, knowledge of risk management activities undertaken, and then the benefits of having gone through that process. Prioritising use of resources, again, really important. The college uses a risk-based approach for its major decisions, and a good example of this is the most recent Capital Works programme, where following discussion, it was agreed that the best way of using its limited resources would actually be not to do the project management in-house, but to actually hire an external risk management, an external project management company to carry out that, so that you got that independence, and it was costly, but it was believed to be well worth it. And I think that was the best decision that was made across that project. And finally, open minds. Again, that encouragement to debate. Any member of a committee can ask anything. Any member of the staff can ask a question around risk, etc. Okay. Yeah. Five past now. Okay. So I'll go through the rest of this relatively quickly, because we want we finish at 2:30. Is it 25 past? Okay. So let me spend about 5 minutes flicking through the rest of these. National Long Service Leave Fund. So this is a national not-for-profit. Its board is made up of people from a whole lot of different backgrounds, and that's the biggest difference here. And really in that situation, one needs to aim for the lowest level of knowledge around investments and risks. So the role that I have there is as an asset consultant primarily, and then there's as an add-on around risk management, which covers the investment risk management, but it also covers the liability risk management. I'm not the actuary to the fund, but the demographic side of things, the contribution side, and also the operational side around administration. So risk insights from that. I think what I found is that risk culture elements are just as relevant here, even though it's an investment advisor role that I have to the board. Risk and opportunity is probably clearest in an investment context. You know, the idea of risk versus return, you actually get both in the same sentence, whereas normally with risk outside of investment, people think of risk without the opportunity side. That's non-actuaries. So the things that I've found are most useful to the whole discussion around the board table on investment risk are just having an open, transparent, collaborative environment so that any question can be asked and that then those questions are answered as reasonably as fully as possible. So one example is someone might come along with a left field question with regard to a proposed investment scheme that would help their mission because it's a not-for-profit, but like that's, you know, from a disciplined investment perspective, like that's a crazy thing to do. But then, you know, listening to that, working through it carefully so that people do feel it's okay to ask those questions and understand better what risk versus reward is in those circumstances is very useful. Leadership is what I've really seen come out there too. The chair is fantastic in organising the flow and the way that the meetings are conducted. So again, positive environment. Sometimes that means getting additional information from outside and bringing that into play. All those elements help support that sound discussion which really contributes to a great risk culture. And the other element is diversity, which by nature of the board makeup from different walks of life is there already, and that helps a lot. Okay, I'll do that. Building a common understanding of risk appetite is really good. That's a bit easier in an investment-related environment because people could see, oh, how much risk do I take or not take? Some very simple mechanisms there that I found were useful was the Vanguard 30-year chart, which shows all the returns by different asset classes as a way of illustrating that short-term risks volatility is actually, you know, a distraction from the long-term risks of not being able to match inflation in a long-term fund. And having those discussions around a table with something simple, it really helps the dynamics as well as the understanding of things. Another one is just answering questions like, what's going to happen on Brexit? Or what if Trump gets elected? My goodness. And of course, both happened. and the advice was just keep calm and carry on in broad terms. Okay, so superannuation funds. Just to list a few of these. So my role really is trustee advisor across a whole bunch of things that super funds need advice on. Some mathematical, but equity and policy-related elements as well. What have I learned there? I really see that super funds are lagging behind the banks and the insurance companies in terms of risk culture. And I think this is a matter of historical significance and the maturity of the industry, the lack of complexity, etc. But I see going forward that's going to change. and super funds need to catch up in a sense on that regard. CROs coming in is a great thing. That'll help enormously. And the other thing is related to all of that. You know, APRA sees this, and it's very keen to see improvement. And of course, you know, I'm generalising here across the industry. Some funds will be quite good at it, but others are not. I think it's tough that there's such a focus on compliance in the superannuation industry, and the costs that go with that, and the distraction of time, really. People don't really get to focus on risk management to the same extent as they should, and you know, risk culture is just, you know, too hard and out there in many ways. So I hope that changes. But there's some good points as well. Unit pricing governance is so much better than it was years ago, continuing to improve. And expectation of standards has risen as well, both internally and by the regulator as well. FinTech is leading to improvements in communication, etc., but I can see the superannuation industry being really blown away if you ever get an Apple or a Google in there with a true partner that can bring the costs down, because it's ripe for that. Okay, so there are just some thoughts. Conclusions: what drives a sound risk culture? Great leadership, leading by example, leading people. Ed Schein, the guru on risk, on organisational culture, will say the top four things that drive the best organisational cultures are all related to leadership. I'll skip through those, so they're all there on the list. You can read them as well as I can. And don't forget the actuary advantage and those skills that as actuaries we have. And the recommendations really are what I almost started off with at the beginning, that acting differently, you know, have the confidence and courage to do that, make the environment safe so people can question, etc. And then influence others. So how do you do that? You've got to communicate, and you've got to lead, and you've got to demonstrate the benefits. Take the opportunities, mitigate the risks. I've given you some examples of that from my career. Risk appetite is critical. Bring risk and opportunity to every decision, and look to innovate constantly. And learn from mistakes. Learn from your own mistakes and learn from other mistakes, which is much better. I'll finish up with just using an analogy that Andrew Brown, my co-researcher and your counsellor, said to me when he was peer reviewing this. He said it's like using your car's accelerator and brakes to get somewhere efficiently or quicker. Optimizing performance. The risk culture is like a brake. Without brakes, we can only travel slowly. A brake gives us the ability to accelerate around corners or to confidently drive at high speed when we know we can do it safely. So thank you very much for questions.
Thank you, Sean. As you can hear, Sean is a keen student of culture and risk, though I thought there was some risk associated with putting up those first two photos. You'll remember, we've got about 10 minutes for questions. You'll remember the routine. The microphone's in the middle. Please state your name and your organisation for recording purposes. I should have said at the beginning, I was keen to volunteer for this session because I am chair of a board of a social purpose organisation. I'm also a director of two APRA regulated organisations, so I'm very interested in the topic of risk culture. So if you want to queue up to ask questions, this would be a good time to do it. But in the meantime, one thing that caught my attention, Sean, my background is life insurance, and so I'm familiar with kind of risk culture in life insurance companies, both mm-hmm. From an exec point of view and from a board point of view. You mentioned that your observation of superannuation is they're lagging somewhat. Can you, just to warn me off if I'm ever offered to go on a superannuation board, how do they compare? What in particular are they lagging with?
Yeah, I think Some of it is tradition and history. So in a life insurance company, you've had a big focus on insurance risk for many, many years. In a bank, you've had a big focus on credit risk because they're the big risks that will wipe those out. But in defined contribution superannuation, which drives most of our current funds, you don't have that single point of focus. So the board and the entities tend to focus more on the operational things or the strategy, etc. And there are lots of risks in there as well. But I think that's the driver of it. So there is a need to catch up. The other thing is around CPS 220, the APRA standards around risk management. The banks and the life companies had them first in the previous guise. So again, super funds have been catching up. And I certainly have detected over the years there's a certain amount of resentment within the superannuation industry of APRA imposing all this stuff on them. And they get a lot of stuff imposed on them, and then it changes again. Yeah.
That's all. Thank you. Yeah. History explains lots of things about culture. Next question. Yeah.
Hi, Ashley Palmer from Aon Hewitt. Thank you, Sean, for the bits that you shared today. Very interesting. I was guessing if you had any examples of organisations that are getting good at what you might call long-term decision-making, because it seems to be the element in this that's hard to get away with is that lots of organisations quite deliberately have to be quite short-term about things, whether it's due to share price or KPIs or... Even in super, humanity gets fixated on these short-term returns. How do you break into what you might call decision-making and time horizons that might be better for the long-term well-being of the organisation?
Mm. Yeah, I'll give you two examples. So I decry the short-term focus that a lot of listed organisations in particular have. A not-for-profit sense of time is generally so much longer. And at the school where we are, we celebrated the 800th year of the Dominicans just last year. And you know, they actually go through, when I say they, we, but you know, the people that run the organization, which is the sisters, who are now dwindling. And have to put in place other governance procedures going forward so that spirit, that mission is carried forward. But they really do look long term, and they stick to it. You know, they have the courage of their convictions and say, what's right? And they go right back to the values of the organization. What are we trying to achieve? What's right? And they stick to that. The other example I have is I recently spent... It ended up being 4 days a week for almost 2 years at TAL, the life insurer. And I remember going for the initial discussion as to, you know, whether I could help them, etc. And the thing that stood out in my mind was the actuary there at the time, Fred Rowley, many of you would know, saying that the Japanese parent, Aichi Life, takes a long-term view. They're a mutual. And he said, that has made a huge difference to the organization. They can look long-term. They can plan long-term. So I think the listed markets really militates against that. I think superannuation funds are just, again, a fantastic opportunity because the industry funds, for instance, are not listed, and they're member for-profit or not-for-profit. And they can do that. So they can stick with their convictions. They have to do all the other things that everybody has to do. But yeah.
Thanks, Sean. I mean, I guess just a thought on it from reading the papers that I've read on it. There's a lot of focus from the regulator on customer outcomes, and that seems to be an obvious alignment. Kind of if the customer's getting a good outcome, then probably things are working well.
But it has to be long-term outcomes.
Absolutely. Do you have any examples of where some organisations are being able to measure that well? Because it is quite hard in areas like life insurance and super, as we know that customer outcomes can be a long time in the future.
Yeah, I probably don't.
No, me neither. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ashley. Next question. Microphone's free. You can get on the queue.
How's that? I know, but I'm going to hog the microphone. Jenny Lyon, SKL. Thank you, Sean. So I thought the most insightful thing you said was that not taking action can be the biggest risk of all. And I just so agree with that, because so often when you do a risk assessment, you go through and you think about all the things that might go wrong if with the new project that you're considering, and you don't actually think about if what will happen if we stay as we are, or you feel very anchored in the current system that we have. So I'm just going to take advantage and talk about the education system that we have at the moment, where we're doing a major review, and probably the biggest piece of feedback we've had is don't lower standards. You know, maintain the value of the qualification. Now, I agree with that. We do have to maintain the value, but I don't think that means that sitting still and not doing anything is going to do that. We actually are at the point where I believe we need some change, and so I guess I'm just putting my pitch out there. The other thing that, again, comes back to things I've been talking about a lot is around diversity, helping the risk culture, simply because we do become very rooted in our own approach to things. So, you know, I think as actuaries, we typically will look at the finances as being really important because that's what we understand. And we forget sometimes that actually, as you said, what is the key purpose of the organisation, and keeping that front of mind is important. And just by bringing different people in who say, well, actually, have we thought about marketing or brand or whatever it is going to just help the conversation. It doesn't mean the finances get ignored, but it keeps the conversation. Then I just thought I'd go to Martin's comment about superannuation trustees. So I'm on a trustee board looking after superannuation products for a life insurance company. And that puts a different kind of pressure in terms of risk. Because obviously, as a trustee, you're maintaining, you're looking after members. First and foremost, it's protection of the members. However, the life insurance company has a profit motive too. And so balancing the risk there is something that we have to come back to quite often and talk about. So I haven't even got a question for you, sorry.
Just
make a comment on the diversity. I think that the area that I see missing in diversity is youth. So you get gender diversity, you get business background diversity or background diversity, but you don't get youth, which is a real shame.
We had another volunteer for a question.
Thanks, Sean. I'm Colin Weir from School Global Life. So I heard a lot of good discussion you were describing about the kind of culture of the boards that you've been involved with. But I'm wondering, given the board have to form a view about the culture of the underlying company, and given that they might be disconnected in some way, what have you seen to help the board get the view of the culture underneath it and satisfy themselves with that?
Thanks, Colin. I'll give you $5 later. Thank you.
It's about communication. So the board needs to be aware of the institution and the organisation. The first step in that is actually getting to know the senior management or the leadership team. The second part is actually attending relevant events, for instance, and some of these things are easier to do in a not-for-profit than a normal company. But that true understanding of what really goes on inside is very valuable to keep it linked. But at the same time, the message from the top through the CEO and in the selection of the CEO is absolutely. Absolutely fundamental.
I should mention it's the 5-minute bell, so still time for a couple of questions if you'd like to take the microphone. Otherwise, I'll answer the question. From a non-exec director board member point of view, how do we get some comfort with the risk culture of the organisation when we're not on the floor, we're not dealing with all the people? I'd say there are two real indicators. The first is what happens, especially in terms of communication, when something goes wrong. So how that is communicated, how many people are aware of it, how it's been shared, how it's been positioned, I think is a good indicator. And the second is whenever things come to the board for decision, and we're looking at what has been taken into account, who has been consulted. So either from a diversity point of view, the different disciplines that may have had a view, the extent to which customers and other important stakeholders have been taken into account, how broadly have risks been thought about, gives us an idea of the risk cultures, whether it's being seen through a narrow lens or a broad lens. That's my view.
Yeah.
Question. Or comments, re-risk culture. The APRA paper, October last year, it was fascinating. Anything you'd like to know from that provoked you from that?
You all have read it. Next week.
Sean, any final message for the audience? What's your wrap? What's your walk away for this audience?
It's act differently. Act differently.
Yeah, so everyone in this room, I'd support Sean says, you're in positions of responsibility, but you're also in positions of influence. I think your ability to act differently and influence risk culture shouldn't be understated. Please join me in thanking Sean.